Good morning, Justice Holland, and may it please the Court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of the appellant defendant, Sean Smith. And we've raised one issue in this appeal, and that concerns waiver of counsel as a trial. And the legal issue itself, we believe the Court has enunciated the principles in past cases, and I know the Court is familiar with those cases. So I'd like to first address what I believe is the strength of the defendant's case today concerning the issue of waiver of counsel.
Would you just articulate the issue as you see it?
The issue I see it is that there was not a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of his counsel as at trial. And what I'd like to address is the record, which is fairly short, and a few excerpts from that record to illustrate why what happened at trial did not comply with the precepts that the Court has enunciated are required before counsel is waived.
Now, does your argument contradict any finding by the trial judge?
No, it doesn't. We do not believe it does because we contend that there really was no finding by the trial judge here of a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel. And there are a few excerpts from the transcript says that indicate that.
Can that be implied or must it be expressed?
I don't think it can be even implied, says based upon the record. The problem started initially when Mr. Hillis advised the trial court that there was a problem. He said something to the effect that, well, after the direct examination of the state's complainant, he said, Your Honor, the honeymoon is over, so to speak, and, you know, we've got a problem here. Now, what had happened is that Mr. Hillis had delivered the opening statement to the jury by that point. The complainant, the paramour of the defendant, had testified on direct examination for some period of time, and Mr. Hillis was about to begin his cross-examination, and that's when the problem occurred. What happened was that immediately after Mr. Hillis advised the trial judge that there was a problem, the defendant said, is there anything I can say to the trial judge? I cannot use my attorney. This is at A13 of the appendix. The next thing he said was, the court asked him, well, what is it? What's the problem? And he said, I don't know the legal terms in this courtroom. I cannot use him. I don't need him as a lawyer. He is a conflict of interest for me right now, certainly. It's a confirmation of there being a problem between Mr. Hillis and this client. The court, in response, said, and this is on A14, are you telling me that you want to proceed on your own? The defendant said, I would rather do it that way. At least I go down myself, someone trying to hang me on purpose. The court, Mr. Smith, do you realize if you proceed on your own, I will hold you to the rules of evidence just as I would hold Mr. Hillis? Now, these are appropriate questions by the trial court under the circumstances. The problem here is the responses of the defendant. Now, and the responses of the defendant to the court's inquiry at trial indicate that the trial judge and the defendant were not on the same page. They're on the same page in the transcript, but they weren't on the same page insofar as comprehension of what was going on. The defendant did not indicate or give any indication at all that he was comprehending what the trial judge was asking him. His focus was on, no, I don't like this man. I want to proceed on my own. And that's all he really responded to. There's nothing in the record to indicate.
He said, reference like, I don't know your court that way. What does that mean?
His response is, they're enigmatic. I don't know what it means. They're enigmatic. And based upon the defendant's enigmatic answers, there's no basis to conclude, and the trial court did not conclude at any point that there was a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel.
Mr. Donovan, let me just try to narrow the issue here, if it's possible. I gather there's no dispute that the trial judge made no express or explicit finding that there was a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver. So if that is to be adjudicated as a fact, it has to be in the basis that finding was implied or implicit in the ruling in what the trial judge did. Question number one is, as a matter of law, does there have to be an explicit finding, or would an implied finding, assuming it's supported by the record, be sufficient?
It's not here, so I can hypothesize that under certain circumstances, not in this record, a trial judge's comments or responses on the record to the defendant or observations could imply a finding of a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel.
Let me ask the question more straightforwardly. Are you taking the position that there must be a formal, express, explicit finding by the trial judge that the waiver of the right to counsel was voluntary, knowing, and intelligent?
Yes. But as a backup proposition, we're also contending that this record is inadequate.
That if an implied finding is enough, that the facts or the evidence doesn't support any such finding.
Yes.
All right.
Well, Mr. O'Donnell, in your experience, I'm wondering if this happens frequently, or how did this happen? There may not be that many situations where people want to discharge their attorneys, but you've listed the inquiry that's appropriate on page 12 and 13 of your brief. And when this court in Boyer adopted the standard from Welty, and we listed the appropriate inquiry, one would think that any trial judge confronted with the situation that we see in this record would just get out Boyer and go through all the questions on the list.
I agree with that, Your Honor. It does, you know, lend itself to a kind of a sheet that, and I know trial judges have those sheets when questions can come up concerning 404B, et cetera, and they should follow, and they are guided by the court's precepts in making findings. It didn't happen here. In the trial judge's defense here, Boyer had not been decided. Now, the court had announced those principles previously a number of years ago in Stiggers and other cases, but Boyer was not recent. It hadn't been decided. The more recent case here, it's only speculation on my part. The more recent case here was Hartman had been decided. Now, Hartman was a little bit different because Hartman was reversed because the defendant wanted to represent himself, and the record indicated there was a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel. And the Superior Court responded that, well, okay, I'm just not going to let you represent yourself because these things go wrong and we're going to have problems. And the court recognized on appeal that the defendant, you know, has a constitutional right to represent himself so long as the waiver of counsel is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And the fact that the trial might be inefficient or have problems is not a basis to deny someone their right to self-representation. So the court, maybe trial judges, because Hartman was recent, underread Hartman, and just reacted or thought that, well, look, you know, if they want to represent themselves, we have to let them represent themselves, even if it's going to turn into a difficult situation.
Well, Boyer might not have been decided, but Briscoe was decided a long time ago. There was nothing knew about Delaware looking to Welty as the standard inquiry that should have been conducted?
No, there was not. I'm just speculating that perhaps a trial judge or two was focusing on the more recent case, Hartman, and looking at the facts as to what holding rather than the principles that Hartman followed. That may have been a bit of a problem. But again, that's speculation.
With respect to your position that there has to be an express formal finding, are there any Delaware cases or persuasive non-Delaware cases that you're relying on?
I'm not familiar with any.
Okay. Assuming then that, you know, we're in the implied finding arena, what evidence or facts would have to be present in order for there to be a proper implied finding in this case?
Critically speaking, the facts in the record indicate that the defendant's responses to the trial court's inquiries, the Briscoe-type inquiries, are responsive and aren't enigmatic. But non-responsive answers simply don't provide a foundation on which to even imply a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel. The trial
Why don't you walk us through one or two of them and tell us what should have happened, in your view, as distinguished from what did happen?
The court, understand that if you decide to proceed on your own, I will hold you to the court's procedures. I am not going to help you. I am not here to help. Appropriate inquiry or advice, the defendant's response. Ain't no one in this room is going to help me. There's a disconnect. He doesn't really, he says, understand the judge's questions. He's expressing alienation, perhaps he's expressing alienation, discontent, but he's not connecting with the judge. There's no bridge there of understanding or comprehension here. You understand you are facing a good deal of minimum mandatory time if you are convicted of all of the offenses. And here the defendant didn't even respond. Here the prosecutor interrupted and said, Your Honor, I did offer Mr. Hillis an amended plea since we started trial. None of the offenses are minimum mandatory. Mr. Hillis would be free to argue at sentencing what his client. Now, the prosecutor then goes off on a tangent about a plea negotiation. And then that occupies several minutes of the colloquy among the parties there.
So I gather that with as to the first question, the judge, the response being a disconnect, should have prompted the judge to repeat the question and insist on a more specific response?
It did not.
And similarly, after the prosecutor, diverted the course of the inquiry, the judge should have brought everybody back to that question again?
Yes, Your Honor, but that didn't happen. The next thing, at the bottom page 815, after the judge told him, you understand you're facing minimum mandatory time, after the prosecutor's diversion about, we may have a plea agreement here, Your Honor, we've been discussing a plea, the defendant said, I don't want no parts of the case with him, referring to Mr. Hillis. Now, he's expressing some discontent with Mr. Hillis, but he's not responding to what the judge is concerned about here. And when there's a lack of, says, response, or lack of understanding, says, with the judge, and the defendant is making responses that don't make much sense.
Well, he is responding, Mr. Donovan. It's that the response may indicate that he is responding affirmatively to the specific question, or it may indicate that he's not, that he's responding, that he's basically providing extraneous information.
There's a response in the sense that sometimes a witness's answer to a question posed by an attorney is non-responsive, and the witness is directed to respond to the attorney's question. In that sense, yes, there is a response, but it's not the response that you would want in order to make these critical findings of a knowing and intelligent waiver.
It may have been helpful, perhaps, for the trial judge to explain to the defendant that there are certain steps that we have to go through in order for there to be a valid waiver of counsel, and we have to make a record, and we have to ask certain questions and listen to the questions carefully so that the defendant understands this is not an argument with the court, it's a process.
That's correct. That could have been helpful. I'm not suggesting it would have been helpful, but it could have been helpful, but it didn't happen. Now, again, the court later on in A-17, the trial court asked the defendant, you understand you are facing minimum mandatory time, plus you will be getting time for other counts if you are convicted. The defendant's response, are you bringing my daughter in to testify against me? They weren't on the same page insofar as comprehension. I mean, the trial judge was trying. I mean, the trial judge was commendable insofar as, you know, making an effort to try to get through, says to this guy, but it just, there's no evidence that the defendant was following the trial judge at all. And then the trial judge finally says, there's no basis, and this is the salient, important, only relevant part of the record. It ends at A18. The trial judge says, well, okay, the trial judge, now I want you to think about this overnight. The defendant responds, I want to do this myself. I mean, nothing has happened insofar as comprehension, understanding of what's going on here, and the defendant says, I want to do it myself. The trial judge, I would recommend to you, it's kind of like, I have no choice, but I'd recommend to you that. And this was the judge's reaction. The judge's reaction to this situation suggests that the trial judge thought, you really didn't have any choice. And then he said, because you have an absolute right if you want to proceed on your own. Now, what is absolute right? It means I can't do anything about it. I mean, the trial judge saw the train going off the rails, but the trial judge's position seemed to be that I have no power to prevent a derailment. You have an absolute right to do it, but what are you doing is essentially sealing your own fate in all likelihood. The defendant, only one in control of my fate. That's just not sufficiently responsive on which to find a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver of counsel, which the trial court never did. And the record didn't support. And maybe the trial court didn't find a knowing and intelligent voluntary waiver of counsel because the record didn't support it. It's interesting that about a half hour later.
You mean the judge was, you're suggesting that the judge was conscious that the record didn't support a finding, but nonetheless allowed the defendant to represent himself?
Yes, I think that's tenable. The trial judge indicates you have an absolute right to represent yourself. It's tenable,
conclusive. Which is tantamount to an argument that the trial judge didn't understand the law.
Perhaps. I don't like to say that because I know trial judges have a very difficult job, and sometimes people point out, well, a trial judge makes an error. The amazing thing is how many things they get right. But it's still an error here. But interesting, about a half hour later, after the trial judge reflects after the defendant's train wreck of trying to represent himself and cross-examining his girlfriend, the prosecutor interjects again after they're discussing a plea agreement. I think, Your Honor, after they're discussing, Mr. Hillis wants to leave. Apparently he'd been sitting there. He wasn't told to be standby counsel. He wasn't told to be anything, but he was sitting there, and he asked to leave. And Mr. Arvin, the prosecutor, says on A64, I think, Your Honor, that as long as the record is protected, if you go through the colloquy with him and make sure he is making a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver of counsel, it's obvious here it was on the prosecutor's mind, too, that, we better make a record here. There's a problem. So make a record of a knowing and intelligent voluntary waiver of counsel. The problem is this occurred after the train wreck.
What did the judge say in response to the prosecutor's request?
I'm wondering about my obligation to provide standby counsel if the defendant refuses or does not want standby counsel. The problem is that it's standby counsel is irrelevant to the determination of a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of counsel when the defendant already waived counsel a long time ago. If the court permits, I would... one more point I'd like to make in my opening remarks. After further discussion that morning about the plea agreement, and they're trying to work out a plea in the middle of all this, and they spend pages and pages discussing it, the defendant is on the verge of accepting a plea while representing himself, and then the judge remarks, and this is at A75, I have a lot of trouble concluding this is a voluntary plea. That's inconsistent. If this is not a voluntary plea, we should be asking the question, should we have determined that his waiver of counsel was voluntary and knowing and intelligent? If the court permits, I'd like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, obviously I disagree with Mr. O'Donnell on a number of points, but I would like to start out by pointing out the number of cases this court has decided on this issue. As far as the waiver of the right to counsel, an unambiguous waiver, that case would be Briscoe, where it was never really, the defendant said he didn't want the lawyer who was representing him, but never said, I want to represent myself. That's that ambiguous waiver of the right to counsel this court has already addressed in that case. And then two other cases, Stiggers and more recently Hartman, deal with the kinds of problems that I think Mr. O'Donnell was pointing out, where the judge makes a decision that even though the defendant has unambiguously said that he wants to represent himself, the judge, after questioning the defendant, says to himself, I don't think you're capable of doing that, and then disallows it. And I think this is where Mr. O'Donnell and I disagree on this absolute right terminology that the judge used, and that if the defendant, and this court has been clear both in Stiggers and Hartman, if the defendant unambiguously says, I don't want a lawyer, I don't want this lawyer, I don't want any lawyer, I want it just to be me and the jury, I want to represent myself, no matter how obtuse the defendant, and no matter how terrible a decision this seems to be, and it's almost always a terrible decision. I mean, it's just not a good idea to represent yourself. It's not a good idea to take out your own appendix. I mean, there are professionals who can do this better than you can. But no matter how obtuse the defendant's answers, and the defendant's answers in this case were, of course, sometimes non-responsive, sometimes very obtuse, but the judge has no choice. If the defendant has made it very clear that he wants to represent himself, the judge has no choice.
Well,
but to accept. Yes, sir.
Isn't the question whether the defendant made it very clear or clear enough in this case?
That he wanted to represent himself. Yes, he made it very clear.
And did not want outside counsel.
He did not want outside counsel. This is not a case where he starts out saying, I don't want this lawyer, I want substitute counsel. Right. That was the case in Welty, for example.
Let me ask you this. It appears that defense counsel is making two separate arguments. One is that the court, as a matter of law, should have made a formal express finding that there was an unambiguous, knowing, voluntary, intelligent waiver. And the second is that even if such a finding could be implied, the record doesn't support such an implied finding. Number one, do you agree or disagree with his first argument that there has to be an express formal finding?
No, I disagree with that. There is no case law that I'm aware of from this court where...
Okay. That's fine. So your contention then is you would have to agree that there has to be a record sufficient to support an implicit finding.
This court has to decide whether there was a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of the right to counsel.
And what is your specific response to the arguments that we've heard that although at first blush, one can read the defendant's responses to the judge's questions as voluntary, intelligent, unambiguous, that in fact they're not. They are not even responsive responses.
Well, the ones that he's, first of all, that very first question, and I think Mr. O'Donnell, I think, is pointing to questions regarding his competency to represent himself. Do you understand that you're going to have to adhere to the rules of evidence, just as I would? Well, obviously, the defendant doesn't know the rules of evidence. The defendant says reference like, I don't know your court that way, which is responsive. I don't know how you guys operate. But that's, again, the point I'm making is that's not the issue here. The issue is whether he is waiving the right to counsel, regardless of whether he's competent, regardless of whether he knows the rules or the rules of evidence, and nobody expects that he does. He doesn't know. I mean, we're working.
There is a process. If all he said, if the defendant said, I knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive my right to counsel, up front, does the trial judge have to go any farther than that?
Yes, he does, because he has to tell the defendant, and this is where the Welty checklist comes in, he has to tell the defendant the consequences that you are going to have to adhere to the rules of evidence that you don't know, to the rules of the court that you don't know. You are going to have to, here are the here are the charges you're facing, here are the minimum sentences, here, this, he has to go into this. This waiver just can't be out of the blue. He has to be informed. Doesn't have to understand everything. He doesn't have to say, oh, I know the rules of evidence. There's no competency test here. If he's competent to stand trial, he's competent to represent himself. But
so the trial judge has to be satisfied that that statement, if it was made, is true.
Yes. And so should receive the statement, even if it's made up front, should receive the statement again after explaining the consequences of representing yourself. In other words, I, the judge, am not going to help you out, which the judge said here. You're expected to adhere to the rules of the court, to the rules of evidence, and so on. You're not going to get special treatment, in other words. And here are the consequences of going forward, just like here are the consequences of a plea. You know, here are the sentences you're facing, and he was well aware of these. There's no doubt about this. A great deal of the argument in this court, both on the first and second day, was regarding whether everybody trying to get him to take the plea agreement. So he was well aware of the sentence. He was well aware of the minimum mandatories that he faced if he was convicted 2 years. As opposed to taking the plea, no min man, and so he was certainly well aware of the charges. And going through these welty checklists, I mean 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6, I think were covered by the trial judge. The judge may not have read them off simply as they're written, but I believe that. He'll have to conduct his defense according with the rules of law and evidence, maybe hampered in presenting him with the judge. Has told him, you know, you're a fool. You're going to go down. You know, the effectiveness of his defense may be diminished. Yes, yes, he was told that over and over. Nature of the charges, range of punishments, he knew. So no included offenses, but I'm not sure that's pertinent. Number 7, I'm not sure about that one, but that's almost like the judge taking up the role of defense attorney. I was a little curious about that from Weldy, and I went and took a look at where Weldy got it from, which was an older United States Supreme Court case which dealt with an uncounseled guilty plea during the Second World War to a charge of espionage, which was a capital offense. And there were many, many things wrong with this uncounseled guilty plea to a capital offense by a German immigrant who really wasn't too sure what was going on. But that's a very unusual situation, the von Moltke case. But
could the trial judge in that circumstance invite defense counsel, who's about to be fired if the defendant gets his way, to put on the record what the defenses are?
On this record, no. No.
Would that be a way of satisfying number 7?
It certainly would if there were specific defenses. In this case, it's simply a matter of credibility. If you believe the defendant's common law wife and his daughter, then that's pretty much it. That was a matter of credibility. Believe them or you don't. If there are specific defenses, specific legal defenses, I suppose.
Well, how many of the, if there is no checklist, how many of these do you have to touch base on?
Well, no, I think the certainly the first 4 plus 6, I think, which are the ones the judge hit on. These are just the common sense ones. You know, if you go by yourself, you're going to have to adhere to the same rules that a lawyer would. We're not going to make any special allowances for the fact that you're going pro se. And the judges always say, you know, if you do this, you know, you're making a dumb decision, which is almost always true. That's just an attempt to talk the defendant out of it, because nobody wants to see a defendant go pro se. Certainly the nature of the charges and the ranges of allowable punishment. But this usually is told to the defendant in the context of you're dumb making this decision because here is what you're facing. If you're convicted of all these charges, and if you represent yourself, you're increasing your chances of being convicted of all these charges. This is you can get as many as, you know, 250 years in prison or something like that. So this is all usually done by the judge in the context of trying to talk the defendant out of making this decision, which judges always do, and I think they should do.
And what's your position with where we find the implied waiver? If we agree there's no express waiver, is that right?
Yes.
So what are the circumstances in this record that would lead us to conclude, you know, that we can write in an opinion that there was a knowing and intelligent implied waiver?
Yes. If after going through the, Mr. O'Donnell zeroed in on A 13 through 18, and then on 18 in the end, you know, the judge says, I want you to think about this overnight, please. You know, after going through, you know, you're silly for doing this, and Mr. Hill is a great lawyer, and you'll have to adhere to the rules of court. Final plea is, why don't you think about it overnight? And the defendant answers, I want to do this myself. Now, that's about as clear and unambiguous as it gets, unlike the case in Briscoe, for example, the court held there had been no unambiguous waiver of the right to counsel. So I would say if I had to zero in on one statement by the defendant, it would be that on A18 at the top of the page. I want to do this myself. And this is after this is following the colloquy where the judge told him he was a fool for doing it and the consequences of his going forward.
Help me understand what happened then. Did they actually go forward and Mr. Hillis stayed around?
Yes.
Or did they come back and start the next day?
This took place during direct examination of the wife or the first witness. So then the defendant was responsible for representing himself throughout the rest of that day. The court mentioned at some point, well, we only have 40 minutes left. I'm not sure quite how long that took. So the defendant was responsible for sitting there during the rest of direct examination and then conducting cross-examination of this witness, which was the state's main witness. This is the defendant's common law wife. And then the next day, Mr. Hillis came in and said, look, the guy's now calling me a racist. I don't even want to be standby counsel. And then there was a lengthy discussion, colloquy involving counsel and the defendant. And then Mr. Hillis, again.
Was Mr. Hillis ever, is there a part of the record that reflects Mr. Hillis was appointed standby counsel?
Yeah, I believe so. It's a said, roll in my head. Again, A18, Mr. Hillis, can you sit wherever you find comfortable? I'm not sure what that means. He was appointed standby counsel. I'm not sure that.
That's fine. We can find it
somewhere. But anyway, beginning of the second day, Mr. Hillis wanted out.
The reason I asked where that is in the record, and we can look it up, because I was wondering if the judge had said something to the effect, I've concluded that you can represent yourself. However, I'm appointing Mr. Hillis to be standby counsel, you know, consistent with what we're searching for in the record here to find the implied waiver or the implied holding of the court that there was a waiver. Do you remember anything that would connect the two when he actually appointed Mr. Hillis to be standby counsel?
No, I don't. It seems to me that almost seemed to be implied. I know Mr. Hillis did remain throughout the rest of the trial, and it was obvious on the second day of the trial when he wanted to cease being standby counsel during some pretrial discussion with the defendant when the defendant called him a racist.
You're not telling me we have an implied waiver and an implied appointment of standby counsel, are you?
I'm hoping I'm not, Your Honor. But it does seem to be the case that the judge, I'm almost certain.
Well, we'll look for it. Go ahead. You continue with your argument.
Well, this is actually, I think that's about really all I have to say. It was simply, again, the state's position that there was here unambiguous statement on the part of the defendant that he wanted to represent himself, and that statement was made after the judge went through at least a number of these Briscoe factors, the more important ones, that told him of the negative consequences of his decision, and wavered from that.
I gather that the trial judge, in going through the the Briscoe questions, got 5 out of 7. Is it your point of view that the other two were optional?
All of them are. I mean, these have always been presented, at least until Boyer, but in Welty, they're presented as these are guidelines for the judge to follow and not as, you know, rigid questions that must be asked. Now, in Boyer, the court did say the trial judge should advise the defendant that, colon, and this, so that makes it more than just guidelines, perhaps. Of course, the aid is all other facts essential to a broad understanding of the whole matter. But I think the essential ones here are the ones that the judge hit. And these are really the kind of common sense ones also. But do you realize the consequences of your decision?
What I hear you arguing, and tell me if I, you know, understated it or overstated it, is that the responses of the defendant to the judge's questions were so absolute and emphatic, at least insofar as the record shows, that one has to conclude that there was a waiver here that was voluntary, unambiguous, and intelligent and knowing. Is that right?
Well, I think it certainly indicates that. There's no indication after the judge has informed him of the perils of proceeding pro se, which the judge should have done. The defendant was adamant that he said, I want to represent myself. And that's about as unambiguous as it gets.
So the answer to my question is yes?
Yes.
Is it your position that if the judge on this record had said, no, you have to be represented by Mr. Hillis,
I think
we would have to reverse?
We would be in Hardman-Stiggers territory then, yes. As I think the court would probably rule that the defendant here had made his desire to represent himself unambiguous, and that the court should have acceded to its demands, and the court should not have placed its own estimation of prejudice the defendant would suffer in the way. If the defendant wants to stand between the jury without the intermediary ship of a lawyer, that's his constitutional right to do so, no matter how stupid a decision that is. And my position is here that the defendant made his desire to represent himself unambiguous. And I note here, he didn't ask for a continuance to hire a lawyer. He said, I want to represent myself. He didn't ask for a continuance for any reason. This came up in the middle of direct examination. He didn't say, let's start over again and give me a chance to collect my things. I said, I want to take over, and I want to take over now. That's about as unambiguous as it gets. No further questions. Thank you
very much, Mr. Donovan.
Mr. O'Donnell, I'd like to ask you the same question. Would we, if the trial judge had said on this record, no, you must be represented by Mr. Hillis, would we have to reverse?
No, I don't think so at all.
Why not? Why
not? Because under these circumstances, under the state's argument, if the trial judge was assiduously making the Briscoe, Welty says, inquiries, and the defendant stood there and had his fingers in his ears, blocking his ear, and every time he saw the judge's lips stop moving and said, no, I'm representing myself, I hate Mr. Hillis, every time, I hate Mr. Hillis, I'm representing myself, the state's arguing here that, hey, he's insistent. The court has no choice. This is the state's argument, essentially. The court has no choice but to permit him to represent himself. And essentially, that's an argument that he has an absolute right to represent himself, and the court is powerless to make an inquiry about whether the waiver is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And in this case, you know, even the effect, insofar as the Welty considerations, the defendant, Mr. Hillis suggested the defendant was going to testify in his opening. The defendant took over his own testimony. The trial court did not examine him concerning the Welty factor about whether it might compromise his defense. His role as an attorney might compromise his defense. And in fact, that happened because the court referred later to the, I thought you displayed some temper with your common law wife, so to speak. Probably you did great harm with this jury. Do you understand that? The court never explained to it, because essentially what the defendant was doing was he was sticking his fingers in his ears and saying, I'm not listening to you, Judge. I hate Mr. Hillis. I want to represent myself. And that's not a sufficient record to permit him to represent himself.
And do you remember whether there was a statement on the record actually appointing Mr. Hillis standby counsel?
No, there was no statement. That was at A18. The trial court said after he tried to talk him into saying, well, why don't you think about this overnight? I want to represent myself. Okay, Mr. Hillis, why don't you give him the file? You can sit there. That's on A18. The trial court said, Mr. Hillis, can you sit in whatever you find comfortable? The spectator chairs are not comfortable.
So that's as close as we got to appointing him standby counsel?
That's as close. And the record doesn't indicate that there was any type of contact between Mr. Hillis and the defendant at all up to that point.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Thank you both. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.